Now, today it's my pleasure to introduce Dean David Quigley, who is Dean of the College and Graduate School of Arts and Sciences, and also Professor of History here at Boston College. He teaches a wide range of courses on 19th century United States and on political and urban history. His research has explored the history of race and democracy between the American Revolution and Reconstruction in the local political cultures of New York. He's completed a new synthetic project, which gives us the title of our talk today, Last Best Hope, International Lives of the American Civil War, as well as editing a companion to American Urban History, and Busing in Boston, A Brief History with Documents. Other books include Second Founding, New York City, Reconstruction and the Making of American Democracy, and Jim Crow, New York, a documentary reader on race and citizenship, 1777 to 1877. He received his PhD in history from New York University, and I could go on and on about his many strengths and accomplishments, but you're here to hear him speak rather than be acclaimed. I know he has a handout as well that we can pass around whenever it's convenient for you. So thank you for being here, and we look forward to your talk.
I'm glad you were able to make it, and thanks for the invitation. You've done a great job holding down the fort while Professor Wolf is over in the UK. I would put in a plug for this later this afternoon, both Lynn Lyerly, my colleague from the history department, but also my fellow dean, Mark Massa. I can promise you that that will be perhaps a more lively conversation than even this noontime gathering. I appreciate this opportunity, although as I think about it over the last year, as we've tried to nail down a date, probably would have been better to do it right at the beginning of the fall semester, where we would have had some time to really get deeper back into the work of writing and thinking about history, as opposed to this moment, which for all of us around the table from the university, we all understand just how we're desperate for the May 24th or sometime in June to get back to our work. But this is a nice way of recharging and reminding all of us that blessed moment is not too far off. I'm going to focus my remarks today on Abe Lincoln, on Abraham Lincoln, the 16th president, and talk about some of the ways in which he figures in this book project that I'm trying to complete. But I want to talk a little bit about this particular moment. I said that this is not the Arts Festival, although I'm making my Arts Festival debut tomorrow night, narrating the Wind Ensemble's performance of Copland's Lincoln Portrait, a great piece of American music. Please don't attend for my sake. But there are a lot of great events over the next few days, and it's a wonderful piece of music. It's going through my head all week, those of you who know the chords that run through it, and evocative of some of the ways in which I'm thinking about this project and Lincoln's place in it. Copland on to the 20th century, thinking about the place of Lincoln in American myth, in American history, in American public life, and imagining his own way of using Lincoln as a muse. It's been interesting thinking about my own remarks today, but at the same time trying to rehearse each night this week and last week with the members of the Wind Ensemble and think about what that all means. As you're all, I'm sure, aware, we're 2 weeks now into the sesquicentennial, not B.C. sesquicentennial, which we have to wait another year for, but the Civil War, which, of course, April 12th, a couple weeks back, marched down in Charleston Harbor, the beginning of the 150th anniversary of the outbreak of the Civil War. For those of you who are not paying attention, the Disunion blog on the New York Times is a wonderful resource every day. It hasn't been updated yet today. Yesterday, our former PhD student, Judy Giesberg, was the contributor writing about Dorothea Dix's visit to Washington, D.C. For someone who's thought about and taught the Civil War for many years, it's wonderful to have this kind of day-by-day, blow-by-blow account of how things played out, both over this past winter, the ugly secession winter of 60-61, on to the outbreak of conflict, and now through the next 4 years of war. And lastly, by way of preface, there's something fitting about doing this in April. I think the lilacs are not quite out yet. We don't have to start quoting Whitman here, but it's both the beginning of the war, and as we think 4 years hence, as we have whatever Blasey might be doing at that moment, the arresting moment in American history of the assassination and the aftermath. I'm not going to dwell on that today, but the ways in which those springtime moments of the outbreak of war and the culmination 4 years later are deeply affecting for someone like me who works on 19th century history. But in the context of this national celebration, commemoration of the outbreak of war, it's worth thinking about what each generation brings to the remembering of the thinking about the past. There's a lot of good work. David Blight at Yale, probably most famously, has written about the memory of the Civil War, ending his study, Race and Reunion, in 1913, the moment of the 50th anniversary of Gettysburg, and the way in which, at that moment, the culture of reconciliation and bringing together North and South would Wilson, the first Southerner in the White House since the Civil War, this moment of bringing together white Northerners and white Southerners dominated the national conversation at that moment. 50 years later, of course, famously the 61 to 65 window of the 1960s, take on an awful lot of different commemorative meanings, but especially the modern civil rights movement and the August 63 March on Washington linked up to a very different moment of Civil War remembrance and rethinking the canon of 19th century American political writing and Lincoln's place within it. I'm interested to see over the next few years, between now and 2015, we've got a presidential race that seems to be beginning now, but to see over these next few years how it is that Lincoln, the birth of the Republican Party, that moment in national history takes shape. Before talking about this last best hope, International Lives of the American Civil War, that I've been working on for about a decade now, let me just explain how I got here. As Eric mentioned, my main interest, certainly through graduate school and my early writings, my main interest was urban history, especially American urban political history, looking at New York City as test case, New York in the era of the Civil War and Reconstruction, thinking about how this greatest of 19th century American struggles, the moment of Civil War, is linked to and resonates with the emergence of New York as the first metropolis, the American city of the 19th century, working against all of those Jeffersonian fears, all of those deep-seated worries in the American political tradition about what would happen when a London or Paris emerges in North America. Again, playing off that tension between metropolis and nation in a country that, at least for much of the 19th century, betrayed a distinctly anti-urban bias, animated a lot of my work for the first 10 years, even beyond, of my work in graduate school and then here at BC. What became more and more apparent through doing that work in New York, thinking about Boston, looking at cities around North America in the 19th century, is how international those local histories were. How the lives of American political parties like the Democratic Party and the Tweed Movement in New York, how institutional histories, intellectual histories, the broad range of historical examination that I was doing in the neighborhoods of Manhattan in the 1860s and 1870s kept carrying me across the Atlantic, not just, though importantly, in terms of immigration history, a subject that Kevin Jenny and other colleagues document so well, but the lives of 19th century Americans, it became ever clearer to me, were more surprisingly international than I had imagined as I entered those earlier projects, and especially that moment of Civil War and Reconstruction, I began to sense needed to be reimagined on a broader canvas. And so I began working, it shows up a little bit in Second Founding, especially some of the ways in which these internationals make their way through the neighborhoods of New York City, especially by the 1870s. My favorite group are some of these kind of exiles from the Paris Commune, the commune arts who show up and kind of recreate radical politics in the neighborhoods of New York by 1872-73. But unexpected voices, echoes, collaboration started showing up, and that very much shaped this project, which has been filling up my scholarly time for a good many years now. The paradox which kind of drives a lot of the narrative action in all the chapters and across the narrative, the monograph that I'm putting together, is the paradox that this most inward-looking American event, the moment in our nation's history that is defined as a domestic disturbance, a civil war, ends up having transformative repercussions for America's place in the world, for the ways in which Americans themselves imagine our relationship to other peoples, other histories, reimagine our meanings on the world stage, what the idea, the myth of America might mean, and similarly, a range of international observers, participants, writers, later commentators take stock of this mid-19th century moment as a moment to recalibrate, rethink what it is that that earlier American vision, kind of Franklin as the natural man, the natural savage, the 19th century vision of Jefferson, Franklin, other Americans of that revolutionary moment, giving way to a very different sense of America's meaning, influence, possible model in very different historical settings around the late 19th century world. I'll talk a little bit about that in a few moments. The hope here is to link up the story of the Civil War, work that a lot of historians have been engaging in different ways over the last decade, to a broader reconsideration of America's place in the world. That has, I think, been one of the most important and getting to the point where you can say most successful recent developments in American U.S. historiography. People wondered what was going to happen after the consensus history of the 50s and the social history of the 60s and 70s and history in the era of the cultural or linguistic turn in the 80s and 90s. Perhaps not surprisingly, in an age of globalization and its impact on all of our disciplines and all of our areas of study, history, and especially American historians who have tended up until the last decade or two to be more parochial, more inward-looking than perhaps some of our fellow historians, have tried to make sense of how the stories of American Catholicism, American immigration, interesting to think of immigration ever being written in an insular way, but some of our practitioners actually managed it, how all of these national histories make sense or look a little different by paying attention to the histories of the home communities back on the island of Ireland, how Catholicism in the U.S. in the 19th century, as John McGreevy out at Notre Dame has proven, has to be understood in the context of the various Catholic revolutions in 19th century Europe. That American history comes into fuller focus, that we get a richer sense of American pasts by paying attention to the ways in which our forebears, the various messy histories that made up 19th century America, were all lived, experienced, imagined on a global compass. In some ways, the successes of this last decade, I point to another former PhD student here, Ed Ruggemer, who's down at Yale now, whose first book is about the Caribbean origins of the American Civil War, thinking about the ways in which anti-slavery movements in the UK, in the West Indies, and here in North America, both North and South, are all tied up in a shared global history of rethinking the meanings of freedom in an age of slavery and emancipation. I think that the successes of this last generation have built on what had always been the area where historians thought internationally, diplomatic history, thinking about the history of American foreign relations, which remains a very important critical field in any U.S. history department around the country. But we've tried to think about how intellectual, cultural, social, political, institutional, religious histories also can build upon to better understand the place of America in the world. Much of this energy was kicking into the historical community through the 1990s. Clearly, the era of 2001 has only further energized this kind of thinking, and I certainly see my project as part of this larger move in American historiography. Quick overview of the book as it exists before turning to Lincoln and moving on to these handouts. I've imagined it as a series of brief biographical sketches, 9 in all, balanced a little bit more towards U.S. folks and their engagements overseas, a few internationals who come to the States in the 1850s and 1860s. But beginning in 1848, chapter 1 is Frederick Douglass's journey through the British Isles in the context of that revolutionary year, which is invoked, it seems, by just about every political blog, left, right, and center that I read these days, as we think about the Arab Spring. How do we make sense of the Arab Spring? 1848 has emerged as an interesting stand-in. I'm not quite sure anybody has quite done justice to the full complexity of either 1848 or 2011, but it's been striking that it can keep coming back to those events of 48. Frederick Douglass, again, the greatest of 19th century American abolitionists and the figure who has the most dramatic presence in the emergence, not just of abolitionist politics, but of the forming of a Republican abolitionism by the 1850s and 1860s. It's striking that he travels through his most important international journey, 1848, making his way through, seeing what's happened in Ireland, in the struggles of working peoples around the British Isles, and coming back and reshaping some of his abolitionist sentiments and his small-r republicanism in an Atlantic context. The closing chapter of these 9 is a study of John Hay, who is Secretary of State at the end of the century, key moment of 1898, thinking of those two as bookends, the 1848, the opening of this era, 1898 as the closing with the Spanish-American War. John Hay, for those of you who are Lincoln buffs like me, you'll know that as a young, early 20-something Brown graduate in the early 1860s, his first job out of Providence was to serve as secretary in Lincoln's White House beginning in 1861. And John Hay's career over the next 40 years is a very interesting journey through emerging American republicanism and the shifting American internationalism that culminates in a very different America on the world stage that we see by 1898 as he's in the McKinley administration. Along the way, again, I can go into details of the kinds of lives I'm looking at and how Americans' ways of thinking about the world are shifting, but clearly slavery, emancipation, and most profoundly the Civil War are at the heart of a lot of these individual, what I'm still working to refine in my argument, collective shifting understandings of politics, of personal commitment, of public values through this period. In making sense of all of this, Lincoln is a key piece. Again, when you write about Douglas, there are a couple of great paired biographies, one by John Stopher over at Harvard, the other by Jim Oakes down at City University. Both came out in the last 3 years, kind of double helix biographies pulling together Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. Similarly, for somebody like John Hay, we can only understand a number of these figures that I trace out from chapters 1 through 9 by understanding Lincoln and his presence in the public life of 19th century Americans. For my purposes, and again, trying to make sense of what can be a very difficult field, writing American history on the world stage. New York was tough enough to kind of rein in and provide narrative coherence to. Trying to do this kind of international history has a tendency to spin out of control if one is not careful. Lincoln becomes a very important figure for me. And so let me pass out, I think I've got enough copies for everyone around the table here. Just a few sample documents that have been helpful. And before turning to them, and at least my tracing out a little bit of a history and then opening up to questions, the way that I'm using Lincoln, and it's shifting a bit because there's been an explosion of really interesting work about Lincoln, republicanism, the figures of the Civil War in international perspective that has been coming out over the last few years. It's been great to see the kind of work that is finally coming out about this moment. But as I conceived it all the way along, and it still remains in place, and I think gives the fullest shape to the work, the prologue to the work is Lincoln's World, a study of Lincoln's emerging, shifting, and often contradictory, at times infuriating, sense of America's place in the world and the ways in which his public commitments were shaped because of that understanding of America and the 19th century world, which is what I'm going to focus on here. And then the closing, and this is the one that can most quickly spin out of control, is the world's Lincoln, thinking about the ways, beginning in 1865 with the assassination and running down to at least the centennial, the famous Tolstoy celebration in the first decade of the 20th century, if not beyond, the ways in which Lincoln statuary, Lincoln panoramas, Lincoln celebrations, Lincoln biographies and scholarship proliferate around the late 19th and early 20th century world, again giving voice to a series of new ideas about America. I can talk about that. My favorite chapter that I've written so far that relates to this, other than the epilogue, relates to Ulysses Grant's world tour, where he goes abroad from 1877 to 1879. I'd urge any of you who've never come across this, there's a wonderful two-volume edition put out by a journalist. There's around a 60-member traveling party who go off with the former president from early 1877 to late 1879. They're wiring back these reports the whole time. Grant's thinking that he's going to come back in 1880 and run for a third term, or that's a good bit of the thought that is behind what he's up to, but he's also developing some business connections. He actually ends up and comes back and goes down to Wall Street, where one of his sons is trying to make a fortune. Ends up getting his trouble. It gets the family into family name into some serious Gilded Age trouble. But throughout that period, traveling around Europe, the Middle East, East Asia, finishing up the tour in Japan, Grant, it's an interesting study of Grant, but equally to see how it is that Lincoln's biography, Lincoln's myth is being enacted in a series of nationally specific contexts. The Western European, most famously, but in a range of other places, Lincoln is starting to take shape as the new American, as the symbol of an America for the late 19th century, for an industrial age, in a lot of places for a small v democratic age, thinking about the political salience of his model in a range of settings, sometimes in a troubling way for political elites. I'll leave that to the side, though, because what I want to do here for the last couple of minutes before moving on to Q&A is to trace out from the 1830s to 1863 to the 1860s, the ways in which Lincoln, at some interesting junctures, sometimes absolutely explicitly and understandably, sometimes surprisingly, and as I mentioned a few minutes ago, at least to my mind, a bit infuriatingly, turns outward, takes this kind of small town frontier politics, the world that he was trying to make a go of out as a Springfield frontier lawyer, and pays attention to, invokes, imagines America's place in the world, its importance in world history, and also imagines his own political prospects and political commitments in this broader global frame. Let me run through these by way of explaining a little bit of how I'm thinking about Lincoln, but also as an invitation, as we wrap up over the last half hour or so, to invite other readings of Lincoln, other ideas, things that resonate here. Of course, the title of this talk and what I'm putting out there as the title of the book, Last Best Hope, it comes from a late December 1862 address to Congress, where America is offered up as the last best hope of Earth. We will either nobly secure or fail at securing this last great hope on Earth. I didn't include that particular text here, but I think the prehistory, the origins of that line of thought, and the reasons for Lincoln's attachment to that way of thinking about the Civil War as having some global stakes will be made clear as we go through it. Let me begin first, 1838. He's not even 30 years old yet, addressing the Lyceum. He's made his way to Springfield, Illinois, early on in Illinois history. It really is the frontier world. The Lyceum is the foundation for not just Lincoln, but so many Western politicians. The Republican movement of the 19th century tied up to these working men associations, local working men's libraries, the Lyceum movement, which will host folks like Emerson and any other Eastern speaker with a populist bone in their body all through the century. Here is a great moment where Lincoln is talking about this period, imagining his own voice within the public life of Springfield, discussing his vision, perhaps offering up his most ambitious take on America as exceptional. One of the opening phrases of Ken Burns' 20-year-old documentary on the Civil War comes straight from this. This is a speech that's invoked quite a bit there and in most Lincoln biographies. For my purposes, again, we can go through that first paragraph. I'll skip, leave it to you to go over or skim through here. But it's the next to last short paragraph on that first page, building on the sense that the American people are so important in world history, so lucky to find ourselves in the position that we did at the end of the 1830s. Again, remember that this is someone who is not a Democrat. This is the end of the Jacksonian dominance. Van Buren is in the White House. This is a Whig, someone deeply attached to the Whig movement. How then shall we perform it? At what point shall we expect the approach of danger? By what means shall we fortify against it? Shall we expect some transatlantic military giant to step the ocean and crush us at a blow? Never, love the exclamation point. All the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa combined, with all the treasure of the earth our own excepted, in their military chest, with a Bonaparte for a commander, could not by force take a drink from the Ohio or make a track on the Blue Ridge in a trial of 1,000 years. The point, the idea, is not something to emphasize the originality over here. I mean, you can see a prose style developing, a certain Lincoln voice that kicks in, and one of the reasons that I enjoy studying those kind of early 1830s and 1840s speeches. But a confidence in both an exceptionalist reading of America in the 19th century, but also a certain safety, security that is assumed at this moment in the 1830s that it will wither at some point as we move forward, but betrayed by, of course, that last paragraph on the page, the one that really has that Lincoln edge to it, and I think runs through so much of his writing down to the to his death in April of 65. At what point, then, is the approach of danger to be expected? I answer, if it ever reach us, it must spring up amongst us. It cannot come from abroad. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we must live through all time or die by suicide. And a profound speech for someone just on the verge of kind of a political career, late 20s politician on the frontier, thinking about at least one vision of America's place in the world, a vision that I think will shift fairly substantially over time. Shifting ahead, 10 years later, Lincoln spends one two-year term on the East Coast, never makes it to Europe, never travels abroad, makes his way to the East Coast, and of course he describes visiting Massachusetts, going to see his son up at Exeter in New Hampshire, the whole East Coast as on a par with a grand tour that late 19th century Americans might have made overseas. But here in his speech, one of his most famous speeches of that career, of that short tenure in Washington, D.C., where his main reputation is as a backbench rabble-rouser standing up against the Polk administration and the Democrats' prosecution of the war against Mexico through this period of time, gets in a lot of trouble and has to live down a good deal of this over the next 12 years until he runs for the presidency. I just want to pull out this invocation and updating, as he puts it forward, of Jefferson and the 18th century tradition of America's relationship to other struggles, to other histories. Opening of that speech, the extent of our territory in that region depended not on any treaty-fixed boundary, for no treaty had attempted it, but on revolution. Any people anywhere, being inclined and having the power, have the right to rise up and shake off the existing government and form a new one that suits them better. This is a most valuable, most sacred right, a right which we hope and believe is to liberate the world. No surprise that Southerners have a way of quoting this in the 1850s and the early 1860s, and it's an enduring struggle for the Republican movement and for Lincoln himself as a politician to figure out how you reconcile a Jeffersonian tradition, this vision of the right to revolution, with a certain capital R Republican commitment to the Union and the federal government in the early 1860s. Nor is the right confined to cases in which the whole people of an existing government may choose to exercise it. Just leaving it off, you can go on and how he talks about Spain, Mexico, other cases all throughout that speech. But in thinking about other settings, other contexts, other challenges in the 1840s and 1850s, it gets tricky very quickly. The next two documents, I'll skip over number three, although it's I always love to include it, just the kinds of meetings that are being held in Springfield, Illinois in this case. Former graduate student Jeff Mallinson does a lot on BC, a lot on Kossuth and Kossuth's visit in the 1850s to the United States. There's a resolution in document 4 in early 1852. Lincoln's a part of this movement in out in Springfield, again getting caught up in Hungarian politics in the revolutionary movements of Central Europe, but they have real salience for folks on the ground across North America in this period, especially and in complicated ways, as you get down to points 8 and 9 in the resolution here. Again, it's the right to revolutionize, to take down empires, to make common cause, basically, with the Americans of 1776. But then, as you see down in 8, that the sympathies of this country and the benefits of its position should be exerted in favor of the people of every nation struggling to be free. And whilst we meet to do honor to Kossuth and Hungary, we should not fail to pour out the tribute of our praise and approbation to the patriotic efforts of the Irish, the Germans, and the French. And that is an eternal sticking point, not just for Lincoln, but for many Republicans in this period. What to do? Last line of number 9 on that page, and that her treatment of Ireland, O'Brien, Mitchell, and other worthy patriots, here speaking about Britain, forces the conclusion that she will join her efforts to the despots of Europe. America's relationship to Great Britain, American republicanism's place in the world in the face of that great empire of the 19th century, always complicated by the ethnic politics, even in as unlikely a place as Springfield, Illinois in 1852. A couple more of these just to run through to give you a taste of Lincoln and the ways in which he invokes or suggests an international imagination through this period. The next is a document number 5 where he invokes or he offers up a eulogy for Henry Clay. Clay, one of the great figures of the first half of the 19th century in American politics, a Kentuckian, a slaveholder, one of the defining figures of the Whig movement, and without doubt the political idol of Lincoln's early adulthood, really through his presidency. Henry Clay, remember Lincoln as a child of Kentucky, Clay was the model of the modern American statesman for somebody like Lincoln. goes in a lot of directions here. It's an important moment, 52. We're on the verge of moving on to the Republican Party. The next document will get us there in 1854. A kind of mature Lincolnian political philosophy is coming into view. Towards the end of that page, that second paragraph in the eulogy talks about the South Americans and the Greeks and the ways in which Clay was a champion, in Lincoln's mind, for struggles for self-governance in the early 19th century. But then the longer portion here, and not surprisingly, because it shows up in so many of Lincoln's writings about Clay, most famously here, is a defense of colonization. And I think to understand Lincoln and to wrestle with Lincoln's imagination of the 19th century world and America's place in it, one has to confront the place of colonization, to remind those of you who don't live, or your imaginations don't live with the politics of the 19th century quite as often as I do. Colonization was the movement founded in the second decade of the 19th century, offered up by a number of Americans with Clay in a leadership role at various points, that suggested that the solution to America's slave problem was to end slavery or to emancipate slaves over time, certainly not immediately, but to move those who have been freed out of the United States to some other setting. The Colonization Society, most famously establishing in the 1820s Liberia in West Africa as the outgrowth of this reform sentiment. It's a great moment of reform fervor in the United States here in the 1820s. Clay and others trying to look overseas for a solution to this fundamental problem. And as you go through it, again, pressed for time, I won't spend a lot of time here, but it's striking the amount of the intensity of his defense of Clay and Clay's colonization. It'll come back in a couple of documents, but it's worth pointing to that if there's one recurring thread in a lot of Lincoln thinking about America in the world, it comes back to colonization, partly because of that Clay linkage, but also because it was so difficult to imagine any other solution to the problem of slavery and the challenge of emancipation. The sixth document is a speech at Peoria. 1854 is the year where American politics is revolutionized. The Whig movement had faded away. We're moving on after the Kansas-Nebraska Act and all the complexities of this moment of American political history to the two-party system that we've inherited today, Democrats and Republicans. This is where Lincoln finds his voice as a leader of at least the state Republican movement. And here again, linking up to international commitments, if you go on to the second page of this, the top of that next page, talking about the damage done to America's image at this moment. Our Republican robe is soiled and trailed in the dust. Let us repurify it. Let us turn and wash it white in the spirit, if not the blood, of the Revolution. Let us turn slavery from its claims of moral right back upon its existing legal rights and its arguments of necessity. Let us return it to the position our fathers gave it, and there let it rest in peace. Let us readopt the Declaration of Independence and with it the practices and policy which harmonize with it. And this is a lot of the groundwork for later, not just presidential, but the rhetoric of the Republican Party as we move to the end of the 1850s. Let North and South, let all Americans, let all lovers of liberty everywhere. This is it always had been present in Lincoln's rhetoric, but I would say that 54 and thereafter, that thread, let all lovers of liberty everywhere, becomes more prominent. Join in the great and good work. If we do this, we shall not only have saved the Union, but we shall have so saved it as to make and to keep it forever worthy of the saving. We shall have so saved it that the succeeding millions of free, happy people the world over shall rise up and call us blessed to the latest generations. Suggesting the kind of rhetoric in that December 62 congressional message in the Gettysburg Address, which I'll get to later. Interesting that it's bound up in this kind of founding of the Republican Party in a kind of vision for what that Republican Party could mean. He moves quickly to the global, worldly importance of all of this. Number seven, I talked before about infuriating Lincoln, that this would be one of those moments where I really struggle with Lincoln, though he's such a figure of the 19th century and of the 19th century Whig Party that one can understand this moment. President in Washington, D.C., a year and a half into the war, things not going very well for the Union movement, for the Union Army. He calls together a group of African-American leaders, especially ministers, but other editors, public leaders of the African-American community, brings them to Washington, D.C. In some ways, it's a historic moment, the public conversation, the public face of America, shifting in some dramatic ways, a president offering up this invitation. Yet what is so striking and what historians continue to wrestle with is the presence, not just the presence, but the centrality of colonization in his talk. He's on the verge of offering up a draft Emancipation Proclamation a month later, after Antietam in late September of 62. He's 3.5 months away, 4.5 months away from offering the official Emancipation Proclamation. Yet on this day, he's most interested in talking about colonization and the desire, his plan to move masses of freed African Americans out of the United States. The first full paragraph on the second page here, the one that begins, "It is better for us both, therefore, to be separated." There's a certain, what do you want to say here? Certainly a remarkable boldness to this statement to a group of leaders, religious and abolitionists from the African American community. "I know that there are free men among you who, even if they could better their condition, are not as much inclined to go out of the country as those who, being slaves, could obtain their freedom on this condition." Goes on and on, that last sentence of that paragraph. This is, I speak in no unkind sense, an extremely selfish view of the case. He's lecturing this assembled group of African Americans and knowing that they're going to report back to local newspapers, local communities, on the results of this. He's arguing for them to take a more selfless vision of what needs to be done, arguing for colonization. Goes on the next page, the second paragraph on that next page says, "Well, I'm not thinking about Liberia, but how about Central America? Think about modern-day Nicaragua." It's a remarkable presidential performance. And again, I'm one who can revel in just about anything Lincoln offers up. This is one of those public performances, again, because it's so much thinking outside in this delusionary way in some ways about what's possible overseas, to send off millions to Nicaragua, to Central America. I find telling not just that paragraph, but the last few sentences on that page, recognizing what the first argument might be as he's offering this up. "The political affairs in Central America are not in quite a satisfactory condition as I wish. This is the era of filibusters, of Walker, of all sorts of Americans making their way down there and trying to set up their own regime, set up their own little independent republics or their own little fiefdoms around that region in the 1850s, and yet in the 1860s offering this up as perhaps not ideal, but perhaps a solution." Again, just moving on, he's struggling to find a solution. Overseas seems to be a possibility, yet there's an unreality to the way in which I think Lincoln is offering up this talk, meeting up with a certain desperation, I think, that is characteristic of the Republican high command in the summer, early fall of 1862, certainly until we get to the moment of Antietam and a bit of the shifting of the tide. Last thing, and then I've gone on long enough to open it up to responses, ideas, your readings of Lincoln here and other Lincoln documents that you might offer up, or the presence of Lincoln in the 19th century world. Just Gettysburg Address, again, we can all go through it. We recited it back in, were forced to memorize it back in 8th grade like I did, go through the whole 272 words. I don't think that's critical here. I think the importance is to go on to the end, where we get to government of the people. Aaron Copland included this in the narration, of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. And I would say, again, using these documents, but also thinking about Lincoln himself and the Republican movement that he is emerging from and giving voice to, it's not just a rhetorical flourish, but it's a result of a fairly thorough reimagining of America's place in the 19th century world. The last point, again, to give some context to this, and something that I've kind of built into my argument about Lincoln and that I continue to struggle with how much to emphasize, is the sense of the course of history in Lincoln's mind, Lincoln's understanding of world history. There was a way in which, for many Americans, down through Jefferson and Franklin and beyond, those who inherited the Revolution, where I don't want to say naive, but an optimistic sense of the march of history, an endless unfolding of greater liberty on the world stage, and especially in North America, was understood, was accepted. I think that here, at the end of Gettysburg, but I would argue across the documents in a lot of ways and in other materials that I would point out, that Lincoln is giving voice to, but also profoundly wrestling with, a different sense of history or a different worry about history. I think that the tragic sensibility of Lincoln, the kind of tragic sensibility of Civil War Americans, portrayed so well in Matthew Brady photographs and a lot of the war writings of this period, a certain wariness of the slaughter, of the 600,000 deaths that they're experiencing through that period of time, a worry about the future of America, of the American experiment, is linked up to a sense that America, that the world, that world history is not necessarily this endless, inevitable unfolding of greater liberty. 1848 matters profoundly in that way. What happened in 48 and some of the closing down of possibilities of liberation resonated with somebody like Lincoln. The worries about the United States being a slave power in the 1850s as late as the 1860s. Most of the rest of the Western Hemisphere had abolished slavery in the previous half century. By 1861, we're only looking at Brazil, Cuba, and the United States. There's a worry about a declining ability for American statesmen to make a case that America is the vanguard party of liberty in the world. And I think that one of the important undertones, and sometimes it's front and center, but it's so much a part of Lincoln's kind of reimagination of the American political tradition, is a struggle in the context of the Civil War with what if liberty is not preordained, inevitable? What if the kind of ever-expansion of an American empire for liberty, so much of the rhetoric of the first half of the 19th century, is not meant to be? I think you see that in the worry of last best hope, of shall not perish from the earth. Some of it is certainly Lincolnian rhetorical flourishes, but some of the rest of it betrays a kind of different American political and historical sensibility that is coming into view in the Civil War era. I'll stop there and open it up for questions, comments, reactions at this point. I think we have at least 25 minutes, if not more.